But our data sets have this idea that governments would come on in and try banning it, and that would last for a little bit, and then they'd get onto the bandwagon as their economy just starts really crumbling. So governments are going to try and control it, but they're not going to be able to. And then our data sets actually have some hints of some governments that get it right and they create tax coin. In fact, I don't wonder, I can say explicitly, that David Wilcock and Corey Good, and whether they are paid for it or not, are entirely disinfo agents. Now, if we contrast this, the Blue Avians, Gaia, David Wilcock fantasy world of what's going on, contrasted to QAnon. You know, QAnon's not selling hope. Not out there saying there's, you know, X number of thousand of indictments and sit on your ass and wait and the good guys are going to come and save you. He doesn't say any of that. He says it's dangerous, shit's going down, watch out, we could get screwed here, we got to be careful, you know.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today I have Cliff back. I sent him an email and I just said, Cliff, I need you back because I've been doing a lot of dark shows and I get so much energy talking to Cliff. He's amazing. I know a lot of people agree with me because they love watching him and listening to all the stuff he comes up with. Just a really bright, amazing person. So I love talking to Cliff. He kind of makes my day. I feel better for the rest of the day. So I invited him back and we talk about all sorts of stuff. He gets into what his reports are talking about with cryptocurrencies. He talks about human origins. Very fun at the end. We talk about C60 and the benefits of the hydrogen-enriched water that I'm actually a sponsor for Kagan Water, and he has been drinking it for a while. But we talk about what hydrogen actually does, how it really benefits the C60. That was fun to hear because I didn't know he had that already. And then we get into all sorts of stuff about where the social order is going and how our world is going to be in a better place. So it's going to be a really fun interview. I hope you stay and listen to this whole thing. But before I get into that, I want to talk a little bit more about the benefits of hydrogen-rich and pH-balanced water. I'm going to show you some before and after pictures. So this is perhaps my favorite one. This shows a colon before and after cancer, chemotherapy. Perhaps these people need it the most. And then the next picture I have is a colon with somebody with chronic constipation. You know, somebody that has IBS. A lot of people have constipation or have issues with digestion due to, you know, the food we eat and everything else. Kagan Water takes care of a lot of digestive issues. And then, and this is why that it's so beneficial. If you look at the antioxidants in Kagan Water, it's equivalent. 1.5 liters is equivalent to 756 bananas, 516 apples, 38 carrots, 3.7 pumpkins, and 45 heads of spinach. That's why you're having such an amazing effect. And you could do that, or you could take all these pills to get that same effect. And we all know that we don't want to be doing that. And perhaps this, I think I like this image the best because I think that the water should be hydrogen and pH balanced water should be part of our tap water. I mean, we should all be getting it every day. And, you know, I just got done talking to some people about their water systems in their city. And I learned that some cities in my state, in the metro area, instead of filtering, they have no filter and they just add a bunch of chlorine to the water to kill the bacteria. And all you're getting is chlorinated water. And to make matters worse, there are other big cities that have poisons in their water. You should go and ask your city what's in your water. I would recommend that. But regardless, even if you're getting water that's filtered, hydrogen and pH balanced water is over the top and what it can do. And the biggest thing is it enhances the benefits of C60, which I'm really excited about. So I have the link right here. If you want any more information on that, I have somebody that gives people more information and is a sales distributor for the water, and his name is Chip Bunce. So if you get an email from him and you want more information on it, he's the one that's going to contact you. So let's get into the interview now with Cliff High. Hi, Cliff. Welcome back to the show.
Hello, Sarah. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and I'm so thankful that you're here. Like I said, I wanted a, I love talking to you, and you always brighten my day, and I've had some really hard shows, so it has been a while. There's so much that's been going on, so bringing you back is so perfect for me.
So where should we start?
Well, I wanted to talk about hyperinflation because I was reading your report. I have lots of stuff I want to talk about. But your report says we're in the hyperinflation phase now. What does that mean, and what are we going to see?
Okay, hyperinflation needs to be understood. Most people think hyperinflation is when all of a sudden milk goes to $10 and $15 a gallon. And, a can of soda pop is $5, that sort of thing. Doesn't work that way. Hyperinflation is really a strange phenomenon. And if you go back to like 1917, 18, and 19, there was a hyperinflation in Germany. And we never hear about that. We hear about the hyperinflation in the 1920s of the Weimar Republic. And there's two different kinds, okay? The hyperinflation that occurred in the late teens all throughout the world. It wasn't just in Germany, but it was more pronounced there than anywhere else. But that hyperinflation was where people basically accumulated during the hyperinflation. That's the kind of hyperinflation we're in now. Because there were people at the time in this, we take Germany as an example, and when the money was being hyperinflated to deal with the economic pressures of World War I, people did not at that point have an understanding that the purchasing power was necessarily going down.
That it was eroding. Right?
Correct. What they were actually seeing from the producer's side, from those people that were working and making real goods that ended up primarily in the German state for the war effort, but nonetheless, real goods to support the populace, they did very well notionally or nominally during that period of time because they were being paid more. Now, the reason that this had to do was that they had to dilute the money because no country can ever afford to pay for war with real money. They can only afford to pay for it with debt. And they just had a situation there where that type of hyperinflation was absorbing the money that the government was printing out like mad. And a lot of it was like being stuffed in mattresses because they didn't trust the banks. A lot of it was used to purchase property. And so it caused hyperinflation in property. But not a lot of it went towards milk. So we didn't see that kind of consumer good hyperinflation appear until 1923. And the reason that it appeared in 1923 is the same reason it's going to appear in our social order here in the U.S., probably in 2022, 2024, in that range. And this is because of a double whammy. Right now, there are people that are accumulating. They're accumulating hyperinflation as hyperinflation moves into the cryptocurrencies because that's an easy outlet. It's a way to suck up all of this excess money and liquidity this excess currency that the Fed is producing like mad. And so it's going into the cryptocurrencies. Now, there are people out there that have made predictions that I think Max Keiser is probably the best and most accurate for his kind of predictions, right? And just off the cuff one day, he said, people will start spending their Bitcoin when Bitcoin reaches 100,000. And that may well be the case. That people will start spending their Bitcoin when Bitcoin reaches 100,000 because they will be just stuffed full of money relative to the Bitcoin. It will be just jammed in there. Now, coincidentally, will that be around 2020? And will it shade into the early 2024 range? And we have a double whammy there as the second wave of hyperinflation is created by the Fed. So we end up with a situation where, as in the 1900s, in 1918 and 19, they stuffed the money. But when those people that had a lot of money saw the money creation rate, the currency creation rate start rising in the Weimar Republic, those people started dumping their cash. So, along with everybody else, right, who was also in the flow of getting this hyperinflational thing. So it rushed into the whole system because they brought with it a lot of the cash that had been stashed away in 17, 18, and 19 in this big wave of hyperinflation that never really hit the consumer society or the day-to-day business kind of environment. Now, we have an entirely different social order at this time, with our consumers acting differently, different vehicles, and so on. So it probably won't play out exactly the same. But nonetheless, we appear to have a setup here that is going to replicate the German experience of the early 20s. Because about 2020, when Bitcoin's well over $100,000 and people start spending out on some of their crypto riches, that will be coincident with the government running into a deep area through the Federal Reserve, a deep trough of no real resources and getting into a real bind. And so the Federal Reserve is just going to print money at a huge rate through the early 2020s. It may be that we might be able to be smart about it and have a lot more people in the cryptos accumulating a lot more during this early part of the hyperinflation, such that we don't have to experience the really nasty part in the 2020s the way the Germans did in 1923. We may not have hyperinflation run down to that level, because it may come down to something like this, where a gallon of milk is one Satoshi or $20, and people just don't deal in the $20 anymore. They just pay the one Satoshi, right? Or the fractional part of an ether, or the fractional part of a Litecoin, et cetera. And so our thinking changes. And in that stage, we're not particularly worried about it, because we've accumulated our Satoshis, we've accumulated our ether, we've accumulated our Litecoin as the inflation ran into this new cryptocurrency system.
So it could
so
be.
So that's where I think we're at.
That's when the cryptos take over, right? Now, do you see the governments, and they're starting to put their own cryptocurrencies in place, and because I think that's ideally where everybody's going to, cryptocurrency is going to take over to a certain degree. There will always be some kind of physical form. But the governments are going to want to control this at some, because how are people going to pay taxes?
That's a big issue. My thinking is, all right, so we have some stuff in the data about the governments, about a lot of different governments coming into crypto space and really screwing it up, okay, for themselves, not for crypto space, because this is a global movement. It is beyond and bigger than any single governmental entity, even all the way up through the United Nations. But our data sets have this idea that governments would come on in and try banning it, and that would last for a little bit, and then they'd get onto the bandwagon as their economy just starts really crumbling. So China's got to go through that over the next couple of years, all right, because they're afraid of it. And their other governments are going to come on in, and they're going to try producing their own cryptocurrency, and it's going to be a big flop. And we'll see that two or three times over these next couple of years in a major way, as very large governments get involved with it and totally do it badly. Because the thing that cryptocurrencies are about is not being anonymous. It's about being transparent, but not caring about the individual on the other end of the transaction. At that point, it's anonymous. But the whole transaction tree is 100% transparent, and governments can't operate. Our current government structures can't operate as transparent entities for a lot of different reasons, mainly having to do with UFOs and stolen money and the 70 years of secrecy, et cetera. All of that, it can be lumped into one category, but that basically the governments are so deep into woo-woo that they've got to fund it, and they can't think of any other way to fund it than theft. And the transparency of blockchain prevents theft, or reduces the potential for theft to ever occur. Now, so governments are going to try and control it, but they're not going to be able to. And then our data sets actually have some hints of some governments that get it right, and they create tax coin. Okay. And so you've got to pay your taxes, and the way you do it is you use your cryptos to buy tax coins from the government at the end of the year, and then give them the tax coins back as you pay your taxes. And so it's an interesting kind of a swap. And the government ends up with cryptocurrencies, see, that also appreciate. It gives them a basis that's going along with the population relative to this whole thing, and they get into sort of, they become more libertarian than authoritarian.
That's the first time I heard of a solution. That's awesome, because you have to track, you have to be able to pay the taxes. And if you do, the tax coins are tracked to everybody, and they have to keep swapping the tax coins back and forth. But that's a separate system than the other currencies.
Correct.
That would work. That would work.
Yeah. It, And it's clean, it's simple, it's also transparent, but it also gets government what they want and what they need, which is this ongoing continuing source of revenue that also grows independent of the tax stuff itself.
I love that, because that's the first time I heard that solution, and that's just really simple and it makes sense. Because they have to control that part of it. It doesn't work. But you have to change the tax structure now, because they're not going to be taxing you based on how much volume of business you're doing and all this other stuff. It'd have to be based on everybody pays a certain amount of taxes, which will cause a lot of political problems.
Oh, huge amounts. Okay. And this gets back to a couple of criticisms I've heard of the cryptocurrencies that are not valid that I need to speak out about. And so we have a small cadre of people that have taken Catherine Austin Fitz's statement and made it into something of an ideological mantra. And they're saying you can't solve a political problem with a digital approach. And that is not true. All right. Frequently, we solve political problems with extra political moves. In fact, most of the major political problems throughout history, it could be argued, were indeed solved without any political stuff being involved. It was not a political solution for this. So you could say that England's issues with China. England, way back when, was buying too much tea from China. China wanted silver, and so they had a political problem. They didn't want to keep giving all their silver to China in order to get tea, but they needed tea to fuel the Industrial Revolution because caffeine was the drug that the Industrial Revolution built up off of. And so the British decided to use a sneaky criminal solution to a political problem. And so they started growing opium in quantity and got the Chinese addicted to opium and then demanded silver for the opium to get their silver back. And they thought they had their solution, cooked and they were good to go. And they introduced a political problem to the Chinese society. And the Chinese society decided to get rid of their political problem in an internal way, which led to the formation of what were known as the boxers or the boxing clubs. And so it was sort of all of these, of course, are all political at some level. But we frequently solve political problems with technology, with force, with all different kinds of things that are not political solutions, that don't involve coming to consensus or getting agreements or any of this. So exactly. And so what we're going to do and what we are in fact doing is we're solving political problems with non-political approaches, because those indeed led to where we're at, not solving them. Any political solution of the past merely contributed to where we are at this stage.
We're going to have a political nightmare storm going on, because although the tax coin is beautiful, that something like that, they're still going to want to, the paradigms have to change in order for that to happen, because they're still going to want to tax based on who's wealthy, who's not, and they're not going to want to make the taxes equal for everybody.
That would assume that the power structure as we know it now and the operating, as you say, the operating paradigm stays the same. And it never happens that way. This television will not be revolutionized is the newspeak for what we're talking about. Okay. And it's like jumping off of the idea of the Russian dog walking hour. The Soviet Union was in chaos. It had been in chaos for years because of the economics of its own internal situation. And then Reagan comes along and starts outspending them forces them into an arms race, which depletes even more of their money with the intent of crushing the Soviet Union. So the Soviet Union had real problems. And what Reagan was attempting to do was to just push them over a little bit. He wasn't trying to create something that caused the problem. He was just taking advantage of the situation that existed in a Aikido or Tai Chi kind of a way to just push them that extra little bit so they lost balance. Well, he need not have bothered. Because what they did, what all of the Soviet Union did, was decide that they had to be far more cohesive in the threat of all of these external enemies and all of these internal enemies and everything. So what they decided to do was to fuse all of the 12 time zones that are in the Soviet Union into a single 1-hour long news show. Now, they used to have news shows every you know, a 5 o'clock evening news, right? Or 7 o'clock evening news. This is before the internet. So there wasn't really any kind of communications other than through television and these media. And so what they had was across each time zone, they had the 6 o'clock news. But of course, it took 12 hours for the 6 o'clock news to propagate across the whole country because there's 12 time zones because it's so big. And so what they ended up with was this idea that, well, we can have our own Huntley Brinkley, our own Dan Rather to guide the masses. All we have to do is to have a single point of contact for all the news. So I think they made it like 10 o'clock at night in Moscow time. And of course, it was, you know, way early in the afternoon for Siberia. But they attempted to create a single hour long news show. And what they did was to spark the White Revolution. And they did this because people could not stand to watch the Soviet Union's version of fake news. It would be like being forced to watch an hour of CNN every night at 9 o'clock, right? And so you just can't take it. And so people did what people do. And they decided at that point that, oh, well, I'm not going to watch this bullshit. I'm going to take the dog out for a walk. And, you know, I can't stand this. I got to get out of this apartment. And it's a little tiny concrete apartment anyway. There's nothing to hold you there. There's no place to get away from it. So you go outside, you walk your dog. And then, lo and behold, you say, wait a second. These streets are awful crowded with people walking their dogs at 10 at night. And, of course, it repeated itself everywhere. Even in Siberia in the afternoon, people were out walking their dogs because they couldn't stand to watch. And what that did was to create the sense of community, but not the one that the Soviet Union was trying to create, because it told everybody who else was also feeling exactly the same way as you, because you saw all these people out walking their dogs. Pretty soon you start talking to them. The next thing you know, you got a revolution going on. And they basically forced the 3 or 4 or 5% of the population that were really, really, really disgusted out into activity. That activity led to more activity. It led to cohesiveness. It led to unauthorized assemblies. And the next thing you know, you got Boris Yeltsin and we're off on and running in our current situation. So you have to be careful about, you know, what you try and engineer there, right? And we're going to see that relative to a lot of these
effects.
It'll
be interesting because the tax issue is the biggest issue with cryptocurrencies and the governments, because I think in this country they're going to be more comfortable with, well, I mean, governments want to control the currencies, but they're going to be a little more comfortable with it here, I think. I don't know, that might be naive, I don't know, but the tax issue is a major problem, and I mean political problem, and it'll be interesting.
It's going to be interesting to see how we end up deciding that. I don't think it'll be a problem because I think things will change so rapidly and so suddenly in the larger political infrastructure that we'll naturally find the tax coin solution when we get to that stage, right? And yeah, and at this point, I actually think we're not there yet where people are worried about taxes. There's much more people, many of the people involved with cryptocurrencies are worried about, you know, all the FUD around hacking and cracking and theft and all of this other stuff. A lot of it is legitimate, but it's rare. It's just overhyped. And we see this weird, well, it's not weird. We see this predictable phenomenon on the net that I used to track with my, in my early data, with what I call propagation studies. So, you know, I had an identity on a forum. I would go on out. I'd carefully craft some linguistics with keywords in there. I would go and post this on a forum and of a particular type, and then I would see how far it propagated in how many days, who did it, what repostings they had, and so on. And I got pretty good at being able to say, oh, I can get this particular language to propagate 10 layers out, that sort of thing, right? Now we're seeing the natural organic effect of that, that people are doing in and of themselves without having a, you know, an experimental scientific kind of a basis or even a reason for doing it other than their own psychology. And so we're seeing it, for instance, around the ideas of these sealed indictments. I'm sure you've heard that meme,
right? I've actually done a couple shows on them, but I would really like to do a meaningful show where somebody who really know, and maybe you do, maybe you can give us some insight, but with your what you've been finding, but I want to know that it's real.
It's not. That's the issue. The sealed indictment is not real. This is stemming from the same meme that Fulford and Wilcock put out as the mass arrests. And now you'll note that David Wilcock, the spearhead of all of these weird false memes, is claiming that there's 10,000 sealed indictments. And as of Christmas, he wrote an article claiming that he could prove there were 4,259 sealed indictments.
They're just making this stuff up?
No, what happens is somebody does some research, they make an inappropriate conclusion, but they talk about it as though they were right about that conclusion. It gets picked up and re-echoed in a fashion by the next layer up in the chain, and nobody bothers to do original research back to the point to say that, oh, well, that first guy was wrong. Okay, so David Wilcock is saying there's 4,259 instances of sealed indictments. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Grand juries for criminal cases don't post their activity in the same areas as do civil cases. If you go and examine all the other cases that are available, you find all kinds of references to sealed material. But it's not abnormal at all. It's not even particularly a large amount. And people don't understand. These sealed cases that are referenced are restraining orders, intellectual property suits from one party to another, juvenile cases, cases of false claims, and we get these sealed things all the time. So if you go to any court, and you go, the bigger the court, the more you're going to get. So New York, Washington, D.C., et cetera, you're going to have a lot more of these kind of things where you have sealed versus sealed posted. Well, these are all ordinary civil cases in which I'm suing you because I thought you stole some of my intellectual property, and I have that case sealed so I can reveal to the judge the intellectual property I think you stole without having to reveal it to all of the world because it's proprietary
well,
to my
the,
company.
The vetting that I so, did a little so, bit because I'm like, well, how do we know that this is out there? And what I was told, well, first of all, a couple of weeks ago, I got a spreadsheet of all the sealed indictments, and supposedly there was six people that did independent research to see, and they're saying that compared to the months, you know, this month, like January, in the years previous, there's like 10 times the sealed indictments. And so that's why we know there's something going on.
But they're not indictments.
That's what they're saying.
They're not indictments.
But you're saying that original information is bogus anyways.
The original information, they're making an assumption that sealed is an indictment. Usually when you get a sealed statement on a trial, it can come in a general way at the beginning of a trial or at the sometime during the process of a trial. At the beginning of a trial, it's where I don't even want anybody to know that my company, XYZ Incorporated, is suing you because I don't want that intellectual property exposed in any way. All right? Usually, and so that can be extreme. Other times, sealed cases are juvenile cases. So what they may be reporting on is a lot of it. I mean, I hate to put it this way, but yeah, there's going to be a lot of sealed indictments in any city that had Antifa riots. Okay, because a lot of those people were juveniles. And the minute that they were arrested and put into that riot, should the government decide to pursue any courses of action against them, it'll go as
so
a sealed
a
case.
Of that?
And it's not
an
indictment
at
all.
Because we did see a raise of that, could have just been that.
Sure. And also, you can also get as the tensions go up in our economic system, you should expect to see more and more restraining orders issued as people come under economic problems and they take it out on their spouse, et cetera, right? So you should see some small growth in that. Every restraining order is a sealed issue because you don't want to put out that you're putting out a restraining order on people in a general sense. It's got to go through this orderly process. So everything Wilcock and these other individuals, now Wilcock is saying there's 10,000 of them
now.
So the number keeps growing.
They just don't know.
They're LARPing. They're LARPing, you know.
I kept saying, I want to know this is real. When is this going to happen? And everybody's, I don't know. Well, it just doesn't feel right unless I hear it from somebody, you know.
Right, right. And see, here's the thing. I've worked in corrections. My father was in the criminal investigation division in the military, so I saw it from that side. And usually investigations and stuff like that doesn't go down this way, okay? And here's another aspect of this. If you really want to know, just buddy up to one or two quasi-prominent lawyers in your area and just ask them, is there chatter going? See, I can't find any chatter when I reduce it down, the context down to the legal world. There's no chatter. And if there were and bear in mind, indictments are grand jury affairs. At the federal level, you got to get a bunch of people together. It's not just a little judge and we're going to slap somebody here with this, right? And so a lot of people are involved at the legal system level within the grand jury process. And so if you had 10,000 grand juries convened, think of that. Okay, so 10,000 grand juries, that's 120,000 people within the juries themselves. That's another 500,000 people in the support structure that know about it. So how are you going to keep 620,000 people quiet about what's going on? You would have so much chatter and stuff going on about in the background. The every damn lawyer in your county would just be on pins and needles because they would know stuff and they're just itching to tell it. See, so none of that is happening. There is none of this chatter level out there
either. And so that was really disturbing for me. It's a bummer though, because I would like to see these people go down. And your information is saying they're going to go down, but it's not like that.
Correct.
Because what you say is the new social
order. Not that way.
The new social order and new global map making. So we are seeing them go down, but it's going to be different. How are they going to go? Because they have to go. I mean, I think if they don't go down, there will be some kind of revolution, because there's too many people that are learning about this stuff.
I don't think it's mutually exclusive. I think they will go down, and I think they'll go down because of that revolution, and I think the revolution sparks from awareness. Bear in mind, only 3% of the population, 3 to 5% of the population in the U.S. was responsible for the first American Revolution against the British, right? This uncompleted war that we had. And so it only takes a small portion of the population to shift the social order. And in fact, here's something that the government is deathly afraid of. And my father had to study this at the War College, all right, in the mass psychology and so on parts of that school. And, you know, I'm stuck there in Leavenworth, Kansas as a teenager. There ain't shit going on in Leavenworth, Kansas. I had to make my own skateboards, and the cops would bust me because I was using steel skates and they didn't like the noise, and I was destroying the cement, right? Anyway. Oh, I'm a surfer. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, though, the point is I didn't have a lot to do, so I read all of his textbooks when he wasn't using them, right? And so the mass psychology for this kind of thing is such that the military worries about what's known as the 10% factor, okay? And the reason that the military worries about it is because the politicals worry about it. And the 10% factor is derives from a sociology equation that basically says if you can get 10% of the population to be absolutely convinced of a proposition and convinced that they are right, even though they have doubts, then whatever that proposition is, it will occur, simply because of the way that there is the spread of influence throughout the social order itself. And so we're looking at that occur right now. We're not even at 10%, right? In my way of thinking, we're just crossing out of 1.5% with cryptos.
But the children abuse is such a powerful issue that you get 1% and it's going to be
Oh, yeah. And see, it's already percolating into the normies, right? Into the moms that have to deal with this and so on. And I'm seeing a lot of chatter about that for the past few years that led me to these forecasts of where we're at right now relative to this subject. That indeed, we are seeing a resurgence and a redefinition of deviancy other than what would be dictated to us by the powers that be, and they want their version of deviancy to set way up here. And the social order says, no, dude, you know, you got to stay. Yeah, you got to be down here. Right. And that's been that major conflict. They've been trying to incrementally bring us up to that level. And over the years, and it simply has reached the point where it's not going to happen. And this has to do with the xenophobic nature of humans. All right. Humans are bred to be wary of strangers and to be wary of certain kinds of change and to set social norms and standards. And that's why we call them norms. That's why we call them standards, because these are the levels we want to live at. And when you start monkeying with those, you get to the point where at some point you disturb the social order such that it goes up into a path of upheaval. And we're there now. And like all things that are big, our social order takes a long time to get moving, and then we'll rush on up and get a big peak of activity, and then the energy is dissipated and we slide off. And it takes a few years. You know, it might take you 40 years to get to where you are right now. And then the manifestation of it might only take 2 or 3 years, because it's really the same amount. It's just really a deal of a building emotional energy on this. And you're correct. The criminal aspects of it, the human trafficking, you know, I mean, now, but see, now we know we're there. Okay. We know we are winning. How do we know we're winning? Because the people involved at the highest possible levels with the criminal activity are so worried that they are now no longer ignoring the chatter. They feel the chatter all around them. It's starting to creep up the skin on their back, and they're starting to get worried about being lynched and so on. So they're now starting to respond linguistically,
oh,
and
so
we're able to see this.
That's how you're able to see it. We saw a new resurgence, at least I have, of the censorship this last couple of weeks with some of my stuff. So it's going to be
sure.
a constant roller coaster ride of that as well, I would think.
Right. And the more pressure you're getting put back on you, the more they're worried. It's a
yeah.
sign of weakness on their side. And now we're getting all kinds of signs of weakness here, where, for instance, you see Bill Clinton coming out and looking aggrieved and about people connecting him to the child trafficking of Hillary Clinton's
oh.
aides in Haiti. Okay. All right. And he comes out and tries to take a big stance about, you're insulting me. You're insulting the Clinton Foundation. We didn't use any of the Haiti money for Chelsea's wedding. You know, we didn't send people down to do trafficking. And okay, technically, maybe you didn't send him down to do trafficking, but he went down to try and rescue her aides
yeah,
that were
aides
arrested
did,
for
and
it.
You tried to save them.
Along with a bunch of... Right, and there's one of them doing 6 months in their prison down there for it. So, you know, indeed, this is the case. And the fact that he's responding at all is, again, a sign that the cracks have gone all the way to the top. The weakness is showing everywhere, because before they used to ignore it and knowing basically that their media would dampen down everything and it would never bubble up enough to where it
so
disturbed
will the
mass social
media
order.
Ever start to report on this, or will they just never report anything and just die?
The corporate media is going to die. The mass media
that's
is
us.
Reporting on it, and that's why YouTube, that's us, and that's why YouTube has such a huge problem at the moment, and Twitter and Facebook and Google, and that's why they're getting really tons of pushback. And so people are trying to do things, they're developing new techniques and so on. And so, for instance, I was amazed that Twitter, you know, the leaks that came out about the shadow banning and how they were going to basically reduce the tweets that use specific kinds of language. And it's like, boy, you people are really stupid. Okay, you're dealing with biological organisms that can think, that will discover that they're dampening down on the language. So what are we going to do? We're going to change our language, but still get the same
yeah,
message across.
And then we're going to expose you.
Right.
And you're going to
and
look
so
really
you're
bad.
Basically, you're going to look really bad. We still accomplish what we want, and we've escalated it back up again. And so basically you're
making
us smarter.
We are going to actually
you know?
Double down and go after it harder. And you've made everybody aware of it. It's like dealing with a teenager.
Correct.
You can't do it that way.
Exactly. A teenage mind. Well, hey, here's the thing. You are indeed dealing with a very immature mind. All right. So we have to acknowledge a bunch of things. Okay, so I have a little bit of background in this. I was part of this thing called the Base Expectancy Study, which occurred in all the Western states that I'm aware of, and maybe across most of the United States. But in the 70s, the federal government paid to have all of these criminal records going back to 1900s digitized, such that they could, and what they said was, we were doing this effort so that the parole boards would have a statistical basis for deciding if someone had criteria for parole. We had 325 characteristics we had to encode into, extract out of their records and put in an accurate fashion into a database such that their algorithms could work on it. And so you'd come up for parole and they'd say, you know, Sarah's a car thief. Not good. Most car thieves are recidivists right away. So we'll make you do an extra year. You don't get parole now. Or they'll say, oh, Sarah's a crime of passion murderer, and she's been here 7 years. Ah, let her out. crime of passion murderers rarely repeat their crime. So rare, it's statistically abnormal. And the crime of passion murderers usually go on to, you know, live reasonably quiet lives and not cause problems for people. And so that was what they were after. In there, though, a lot of the things that came out, because you had psychological records, you had all these kind of things for all these prisoners going back into the, in our case, back to the 1800s, because Washington State did a really good job of maintaining their records about all of these things. And so we had records on the sex criminals and the pedophiles, those that survived prison, because bear in mind, a lot of people are in prison as criminals because they were abused and they can't deal with it any other way. But the, and they take it out on child predators that are then incarcerated. Those that survived prison almost always ended up dying in prison in a later incarceration. Those that were ever caught again, and we assume that almost every one of them was a recidivist, was repeating their crime over and over again, right? And one of the things that I remember reading that really struck me was that every single one of the cases that I had that I went through that had psychiatric records, they all pointed as to the basically the immaturity, how these minds that are there were could be sociopathic, could be psychopathic, were indeed exhibiting psychopathic behavior, but the mind was not particularly sophisticated. That mind was very much the, you know, high school, what we think of as like the high school male mentality that just, you know, socially awkward, unable to deal with things, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's why the children were their victims, because they were less able to defend themselves. And this mind could not have done that to an adult, because an adult would say, what? You know, get out of here, you know, that kind of thing, right? So it gets really interesting as we go along, and you're quite correct. It is as though we are dealing with a collective teenage mind, and we need to bear that in mind as we go along, that these people are not mentally swift. They may be politically astute, they may have power, they may have money, they may have connections, but they're not the greatest thinkers around.
And I think a lot of
so they're going to make a lot of mistakes.
Animal instincts that make you want to do those things are the unsophisticated. I mean, the more mature, developed people don't want to do that kind of stuff. You know?
Right. Yeah, you're educated out of any of that kind of thing anyway. And yeah. And there's a lot of other things that go along with it in terms of, you know, how badly our social order does things. So I can get into some really weird correlations, not necessarily causative, that are just. Okay. So it appears that as though any society, any social order that institutionalizes or permits at a legal level male circumcision will have an abnormally high level of sexual predators of all kinds, and they'll have an abnormally high level of pedophilia within their social order compared to those societies that don't practice circumcision.
Is that because it's a trauma that we put on a little baby that affects them right away?
There is that. There's certainly damage there, but I would dispute that. It's because, in my opinion, it's because we chop off in male circumcision, they chop off some 2 to 5 million necessary hormonal receptor and hormonal creation cells. And without those, the male brain does not mature. Okay, so there is actually a quantifiable, the U.S. military did a study. They did it in 47, and one aspect of it was dealing with corpses. And then they did it again, I think it was maybe as late as the 1990s, but I don't know for sure, but I know the second study was done, albeit with a smaller level of people. But they did all these autopsies, and they basically discovered a correlation between mental development in terms of the actual brain, not mentition, but the actual brain development and circumcision. And that men that were circumcised will have some degree, because it's not, you know, it's some are extremely
circumcised. Some get past it, right? And
correct.
Others, yeah.
Most will develop some compensatory level as a, you know, a fully functional adult and so on. But a lot of men lose maybe 5 million of these cells, but some only lose 1 million. And there may be some key cells in there that actually trigger the epigenetic component that causes the brain to develop adequately and so on. So there is a correlation. It's not causative. If they could, maybe it's one single cell in a band, you know, somewhere in the foreskin, that if they chop that off, that causes the brain not to react the way that it would have otherwise. But you don't have all these hormonal receptors. Another correlation is that societies that practice male circumcision have very high divorce rates, and it's not seen, and you have very low instances of lifelong cohabitation. So that's, again, another part of the maturity of the mind kind of thing, right? And I'm not saying that circumcised men are all going to be immature, but I'm going to suggest that there has been some level of mental development damage done in the circumcision process, and it doesn't show up until 20 plus years later, right? The first one was done in 1947, and we had a difference then because there were so many men that were not circumcised, they actually labeled this condition as a disease, or not a disease, but a potential thing to be looked into they thought it was a disease. They did not make the correlation between circumcision, and they noted it in the records, but they didn't make this connection mentally. And then like I say, it was maybe the 80s or 90s, there was I don't know that it related to, I'm going to go into that, but in the 80s or 90s, when they repeated the study, they didn't have the vast number of people that they had in 40s, because in the late 40s, when they did the study, when the study was compiled, they'd been dealing with autopsies that had been done from so many people that were killed in World War II, right? So that's how they got that particular base. Now, in that generation, though, far fewer men were circumcised than in the generation that they found in the second study. And so when they did the second study, they found their percentage of circumcised men was maybe 70 or 80%, whereas in the first study it was maybe 20 or 30%. It was low enough in the first study that they thought those brains were in some way a level of abnormal development. They were trying to put it down to nutrition or any of this kind of stuff. Bear in mind that things like vitamin D against rickets is well known as coming on out, but it was really promulgated by the military. Because the military wanted fit people to be in their army. They didn't want people with weak bones and stuff. So once they figured out a cure for rickets, the military put the money behind it to get the vitamin D added to the milk and all of these other kinds of things, right? And they do that all the time because they want fit soldiers for their next war. And so they study things like this all the time. So
So you know there's a joke. You know there's a joke that goes with that.
you tell me yours. You tell me yours.
Well, I mean, they say that men think with their penises.
Right. So. Right. I was just going to say exactly so. Right.
But getting more serious now, that should be out there, because I think that most parents, there's probably a certain amount that will do it anyways for cosmetic reasons, but who would circumcise their kid knowing that that's the truth? You know,
I know.
I mean, it should end overnight.
I know. And that's the way the Germans are looking at it now, because they've really tumbled to this. And there's some non-public, I'm not going to say secret, but there are some non-public documents in the hands of the German government that are fueling the current German backlash against circumcision as a practice in any cases other than absolute medical need. So they're not even going to allow it they don't even want to allow it as an elective surgery. And they certainly,
I would agree with that.
Right. And they certainly don't want religious people involved with it. Right.
No.
So now there's a difference too, by the way. Okay. So here's an interesting thing. When you circumcise men at a very young age, infants, you get this effect. But there's a social order on this planet that does not do that. In fact, there's many. There's a bunch of social orders that will circumcise teens, both male and female. Okay, the Islamic for one, right? And so when you circumcise teens at that level, and we see that in the Islamic tradition, but we have to also weed out all these other issues there. But anyway, when you see that, you don't quite see the same level of non-mental development. So you've gotten whatever it is, it's triggered the epigenetic thing. If you circumcise these children at 11, 12, 13, and 14, they've got more of the whatever it is out of those particular hormonal reactions that cause the mind to grow, or the brain to grow.
I would think that would be so painful at that age. I suppose it's just as painful as an infant. We just don't think about it.
Sure. Same number of cells, same pain response, just the inability to slug you in the face at the time. So,
it's
you know.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things you were talking about is the physical boundaries of countries will change. Now, are we talking physical boundaries of social order, or are we talking actual physical boundaries of countries and map making? So is the United States going to change its whole layout?
Yeah, that sure seems to be the important information coming out of the data. It gets a little bit diverse because some of these map making changes are going to be as a result of actual physical planetary changes. So we'll have to have new maps as waters recede and new coastlines emerge, new land bridges appear that didn't used to be there except in the way ancient past, this sort of thing. So we'll actually have to have new maps. But then also there's going to be a social realignment, okay? And the social realignment may see a dozen new countries in Europe, none of which want to have anything to do with the old dying economic union, kind of a thing, right? And these will be people that will decide, we don't want to live with all of those other people. We want to do it here and try and do it right. We want to start over, you know, those kind of things. There's also going to be yet another, and we're into it here in the U.S., yet another wave of revolutions around the planet. And some of these are going to be driven by the ice age. And so as the conditions become too inclement and crops fail and so on, we're going to see a diaspora. They're going to see the scattering of the people, which means somewhere you got to absorb more people. So the idea of refugees is going to be entirely different 5 years from now than it is now with George Soros and the wars as the prompts for all the refugee movements. In the future, it's going to be because it's not possible to sustain the agriculture in that area or the habitation, et cetera. It'll just be too costly to whatever, and we'll just shift around a bunch. And that'll cause new map making to occur as we have to accommodate the way in which the populations themselves need to reorganize themselves. And it's going to get really chaotic at that level, yeah.